Thank you, number four. Tell you what, we are very blessed to have the men who are willing to, not just willing, but able, capably to stand and lead us in worship. That's a scary thing. If you've never tried to do that, stand and lead singing in front of a group of people, it's always difficult. If you're trying to follow Tommy, it's especially daunting. So I don't relish that task at all. And Steve did a great job this morning. Really appreciate him for doing that. It has been a good morning to be together. We've got a lot of folks who are out today. Some are out sick. Some are traveling. Some are, I know Tommy's and Elaine have gone to the Be the Bush graduation for a couple of guys they built relationships with. And so I'm really thankful for that. There's a lot of good things going on with Forest Mill Church. Upward continues to be a great thing. I don't know if you've gotten to go and see a game yet, but it is it's a really special time. Really encourage you to do that. I didn't play basketball a lot growing up. I'm not built for basketball. I am built for football. But I tried out every year because that was what you're supposed to do if you're a guy. And one year I actually made the team. Well, I sort of made the team. It was in ninth grade, and me and another guy, we shared the 15th uniform. So we would take turns every other game getting to play. So part-time manager, part-time just sitting on the bench. I didn't really play much at all, but I made the team, and I'm really thankful for that. And I gave up basketball after that year. It was clear that I wasn't going to make it. And it hurt. Every year I would try out and I didn't make the team. Oh, it hurt. Because oftentimes, you know, I knew the coaches really well. They coached me in other sports and felt like I had a good relationship with them. So when they didn't pick me for the team, it felt a little bit like betrayal. Maybe you remember that from elementary or middle school or high school when you would go out for something and not get it, that or maybe you're on the playground when they're picking teams to play a game or play ball and you don't get selected or get selected towards the end, how that stings. Well, have you ever been really and truly, though, betrayed by someone? I mean, someone that you loved and trusted explicitly, only to have them turn their back on you. Do you remember what that was like? Do you remember what you felt like when someone did that to you? What are some words that we might use to describe that feeling? You know, when we're betrayed by someone we love, it hurts. Maybe more than anything else, it hurts. It's an emotional wound that for some people is terminal. Like they carry that wound with them for the rest of their days. And it drives them steadily forward. Some in seeking revenge, some in seeking justice. You know, it can really stay with us for the rest of our lives. Betrayal is so hurtful that even when it isn't us, if it just happens to someone we love, you know, if someone betrayed my kids or my wife or one of you that I love, which is not all of you, but not several of you, even if it just happened to someone that I cared about, right? I feel that pain and that anger, right? We want to lash out on their behalf. We want to fix it for them. Maybe that's why, more than anything else, we despise the name of Judas. Now, I know guys named all sorts of apostle names. There's Peter, and there's John, and Thomas, and Andrew, and Simon, and Matthew, and Philip. I even know a Thaddeus and a Bartholomew. But I don't know anybody who's named their child Judas. They may be out there. There may probably is some unfortunate soul whose parent chose to label them with that. But it is certainly not a very common name. No one in their, you know, biblically sound mind would name their child Judas. You know, the name Judas is so despised that it's become a descriptor. It's a label, a noun that's used to describe anyone who can't be trusted, anyone you believe to be disloyal. If you had a friend who turned their back on you, you might say, well, he's a Judas, or she is a Judas, right? Well, this morning, we come to John's account of Judas's betrayal of Jesus. And it's my hope for this morning, my prayer for this morning, that we will see Judas and his relationship to Jesus in a new light. Because like it or not, you and I are a lot more like Judas than we'd care to admit. Starts in John chapter 18, beginning at verse 1. I'm just going to read a little bit and kind of break it down so that we understand by the time we get through this passage. We'll be looking at verses 1 through 9 this morning. Beginning in verse 1, when he had finished praying, talking about Jesus here, obviously, right? Jesus had finished praying there in the garden. Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. Now, on the other side, there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Now, quick note here about geography. The Kidron, it's sometimes called a valley. Sometimes it's called a creek or a stream or a brook. It was a mostly dry stream bed, except in winter when they received more rains. And it was located just outside of Jerusalem. Now, by law, Jews were required to spend the night in Jerusalem for this particular feast. That was the way they celebrated. But extended, that sort of extended beyond the immediate city to include the surrounding countryside, all the way out to the Mount of Olives. So if you were there to celebrate the feast, you could stay anywhere in that sort of circle. And this particular valley is most famous for being the place where foreign idols were brought to be burned, where the altars to the foreign gods were brought to be destroyed. It's recorded in the book of Kings, recorded in the book of Chronicles as well. So Jesus, walking towards his death as he is, he's quite literally covering his feet in the dust of Israel's sins. Their betrayal to God's covenant is what he is walking through on the way to be sacrificed to his Father, God. Continuing on in verse 2. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. Now, despite all that's going on today, don't want you to focus on the fact that we've got chiefs and officials going on right here in the same passage. John uses a word here that's not used in any of the other gospels. He's the only writer to use this word. It refers to the group of soldiers as a detachment. The Greek word there, spera, means a detachment. And it's a Roman detachment was 1/10 of a legion. A legion's 10,000 soldiers. So 1,000 soldiers, in theory, more often it ended up being more like 600. But it's a lot of soldiers. It's several hundred soldiers right here. Now, I'm not sure what you pick. When you picture in your mind Jesus in the garden and this group of people coming for him, what you had pictured, but I just don't imagine several hundred people. I picture, 30, 40, 50, maybe, carrying torches. That's a sufficient mob in my mind. But what's described here in John's gospel is much, much bigger than that. And why are they carrying all these torches and weapons? I mean, what's the big deal? Why are they making such a big deal of this? Well, during Jewish feasts, because the Romans had so many problems historically with Jewish uprising, there were extra soldiers brought into Jerusalem because they feared that here all these Jewish people are going to come together for their feast and they're going to get riled up and they're going to start an uprising and then we're going to be overwhelmed with sheer numbers. So they brought in extra soldiers around these times. And they had reason to believe, based on the testimony of the Jewish leaders, and confirmed by Judas, apparently, that Jesus is going to lead a revolt. Hence the weapons. So they're not coming to arrest a false prophet or a bad teacher. They're not coming to arrest a peaceful rabbi. They're coming because it's been reported to them, these Roman soldiers have heard on authority that Jesus is going to lead a military uprising, which if you've read John's gospel or any of the other gospel accounts for that matter, you know, couldn't be further from the truth. Jesus had no desire for military power. So here's this Passover, and you've got traditionally a full moon for the Passover. They timed their calendar by the moon, so you would have a full moon. But they bring these torches because they're going to need to search this garden and hunt down the guy who is leading an uprising, right? They fully expected when he sees all these soldiers showing up with torches and weapons, he's going to run and hide. No matter how big his army is, it's not going to be enough to counter all these Roman soldiers. So that's a perfectly normal response. When an army of trained killers is coming after you, you run and hide, right? But that's not what happens. Beginning in verse 4, Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there among them, with them. And when Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Now this seems like a strange response for a few reasons. One, they came to the garden expecting to have to hunt Jesus down, right? And drag him back to be tried. Instead, Jesus goes out to meet them, and when he meets them, he begins questioning them. Jesus is the one who opens with the question. And when they tell him they're seeking Jesus the Nazarene, notice Jesus' response. He says, "I am he," is the way it reads, but literally what Jesus says is, "I am." I am. As in the unutterable name of God. Now, the boldness and authority with which Jesus says this is not what they're expecting. And it sort of takes the crowd aback. So much so that it says they fall to the ground in response. Whether it's because of Jesus or what he said, it's a little unclear. But clearly, they're not expecting the way this is going. It's almost like all of that military might and power and weapons and soldiers, all of that in the face of God is truly powerless. Now, unlike any of the other gospel accounts, John is going out of his way to demonstrate who Jesus was on a cosmic scale, not just historically being the Messiah to the Jewish people, not just a healer or a prophet, or even a priest. John is going bigger than that. He's going cosmic scale, that Jesus was in fact in control of this entire situation. Jesus is not just an innocent martyr who was dragged to an early death. That would be a terrible story. But that's not what's happening here. He was God himself choosing to place his life on the line. Verse 7, again he asked them, "Who is it you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they said. Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he." Again, just "I am." "If you're looking for me, then let these men go." Obviously pointing or motioning towards his followers, his disciples. "This happened so the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave me." Now, by taking charge the way Jesus has, he has effectively directed all of their attention on me. "Don't worry about the people with me. I know you're expecting an uprising. I know you think I'm bringing a military coup. Don't worry about them. Just focus it all on me." He's sparing his disciples from being caught up in this net that's come to drag him in, right? Now, years later, these same disciples would themselves find themselves in very similar circumstances because crowds are going to be hunting them down. And the authorities in them, in those cases, they're not hunting for Jesus. They're hunting for them. So why did Jesus sort of preemptively stop that? If they're going to be hunted down by crowds anyway, why protect them now? And it's because their faith wasn't strong enough, at least not yet. Their faith wasn't strong enough to survive this physical arrest and interrogation. That would have cost them the little faith they had at this point. And so Jesus, in an act of selflessness and an assurance of his mission, I know who I am, I know who I'm, what I am here for, this doesn't involve them. He offers them the security of standing up for them. Now, just like Jesus spoke about in his prayer back in chapter 17, verse 12, he says, you know, that I might not lose one of them. Well, this is that playing out. That makes Jesus the good shepherd back in John 10, where it says the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. That's Jesus. It's Jesus laying down his life for the sheep. And what's really amazing here about Jesus' actions is that he is doing all of this in the middle of being betrayed. And he's being betrayed not just by anyone, but by a man he loves, right? Do you remember how you felt when you were betrayed? But Jesus doesn't do what I would do, what likely you would do. Jesus doesn't lash out. He doesn't seek revenge. He doesn't even try to avoid the conflict. He just sort of boldly steps in to accept the betrayal. These men have come to arrest and mutilate an innocent man, and Jesus knows this and walks into it with open arms. And as angry as it makes you and me and Simon Peter, who, by the way, stands up and cuts a guy's ear off with a sword, in this story, we don't identify with Jesus because we are not the betrayed. In this story, we are the betrayers. You and I, and I know what you're thinking here. You're thinking, there's no way, right? I don't ever read this story and say, yeah, I can see being Judas. No way. You know, I think about myself. I think, you know, I'm faithful. I'm loyal. I love Jesus. I'm more like Peter. I'd stand up to defend Jesus, right? And yes, Peter does defend Jesus. And then a few hours later, it's Peter who denies even knowing Jesus. The point of the story is not that we're like Jesus and everybody else who doesn't love Jesus is bad like Judas. The point of the story is that both friends and enemies of Jesus all wind up betraying him at some point. And you and I are not good enough to escape that net. Maybe you are strong and loyal and faithful and good now, but I bet you don't have to think too far into your past to think about an occasion when you weren't. A time maybe when you felt weak and weary, and lost and lonely, just like Peter, just like Judas. The point of the story isn't just that we all know we'll betray Jesus. The point is that Jesus knows that we're going to betray him, and he still chooses to shelter and protect us in the palm of his hand. Jesus knows they're going to betray him, and he still chooses to lay down his life on their behalf, on our behalf. Jesus knows, and yet still he asks, "Who is it that you want?" And even though we know we're guilty, I know I'm guilty, you know you're guilty, even though we know we betrayed him, even though we know we don't deserve it, he still asks, "Who is it you want?" So my prayer for you, my prayer for us as a community this morning, is that we will be able to look in the eye and say, look, I know this This looks bad. I know I haven't done right, but I still want Jesus of Nazareth. It's Jesus of Nazareth that I seek. Not because I've been good enough to get Jesus of Nazareth, not because I deserve to get Jesus of Nazareth, not because I know all the things to get Jesus of Nazareth or have all the morals to get Jesus of Nazareth, but despite being wrong and broken and a betrayer, I want Jesus of Nazareth. Maybe you're at that point this morning. You realize just how far from Jesus you've wandered. And still, Jesus looks at you, not with judgment and condemnation, but with open arms, saying, even now, who do you want? I hope you want Jesus the way he wants you to want him. And if we can help you with that this morning in any way, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?